You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through the book of Ecclesiastes, chapters 1 through 4.
He says, "Therefore, I turned my heart and despised all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun." I got to tell you, this is how I felt on Natalie's wedding day. It was so frustrating. Here I am. I had spent 21 years developing this wonderful young woman. Wasn't all me. Kathy had something to do with it. The Lord had a lot to do with it. But we had spent 21 years developing this beautiful, wonderful young woman. I cultivated with her this delightful friendship that meant so much to me. Only to have her grow up, move 2 hours away, and live with a guy I barely knew. And now I see her infrequently, and I got to tell you, that's the pits. If that's how life works, that's the pits. It's frustrating. Verse 21, "For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil." And Solomon knew this firsthand. For you remember the story. He leaves his kingdom to a foolish son by the name of Rehoboam, who tears into the kingdom that Solomon had helped unify. Rehoboam acts foolishly. He listens to the snotty-nosed rich kids who don't know anything, but he listens to them. And in response to their counsel, he hikes the taxes in the land, and it causes the northern 10 tribes to rebel against Jerusalem and Judah in the south, and it splits the kingdom, and it stays that way for over 200 years. He says, "For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity." Life is so frustrating. You spend your night, you spend your days working like a dog. But then you spend your nights, you're staying up late. You're planning and you're plotting and you're praying. You're trying to keep your business afloat. You're trying to raise your kids. You know, you stay up late a lot when you got teenagers at home. I mean, you stay up late a lot. And then they grow up, they leave you, they forget about you. You know, life goes on. Are you turn this business that you've built, you know, you turn it over to your spoiled brat kid who lacks the wisdom to sustain what you've started. Everything you've worked for gets squandered. This is life. Think of John Harvard. John Harvard was a dedicated Christian. John Harvard believed that his Bible was the Word of God. John Harvard donated his vast fortune to the university that now bears his name. He wanted to train men who would go out and propagate the Christian faith. And yet, sadly, today, Harvard University has become the bastion of humanism and liberal philosophy. I mean, John Harvard must be rolling over in his grave. Now, you would think that Solomon's frustrations with pleasure and with palaces and with posses and with prime rib dinners and with Taylor Swift concerts, you would think that his frustration with life under the sun would cause him to be an ascetic, that he would resort to a life of asceticism, of denial, that he would encourage us to renounce all pleasure, to minimize our possessions. But notice this, he takes the opposite approach. Verse 24, he says, "Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor." Remember the scope of Solomon's search. Under the sun, he says, there's nothing better. Just looking at life under the sun, there's nothing better than to eat and drink and enjoy your life. You know, 1 Timothy 6, verse 17 tells us that God gives us richly all things to enjoy. Hey, pleasure isn't sinful. I hope you know God created life to be pleasurable. Good music, steak dinners, good friends, sex with your spouse, walks in the park. These are all blessings that are meant to be enjoyed. Here's the problem. We expect more out of life than life can deliver. We put too much pressure on these things. We're trying to squeeze meaning out of these things, and they were never intended to give us meaning. Here's the point. Life is not God. And we have tastes that only God can satisfy. Solomon is saying that God wants us to enjoy life under the sun. That's why he created it. But when it comes to true fulfillment, we have to look above the sun. Soul satisfaction is found in the blesser, not the blessings. And yet that doesn't mean that the blessings of life are evil. The pleasures and the possessions, the food and the drink that God provides us should be enjoyed. Go home. Eat a steak tonight. Get in a hot tub. Pour you a big old Coca-Cola. Listen to some nice music. Sip some coffee with your wife. Enjoy life. God meant for it to be enjoyed. Our frustration comes, though, when we try to squeeze from life more than it offers. When we try to look at life as a final pursuit and think that life under the sun is all there is, that's not true. And that's what leads to frustration. Don't take your life under the sun so seriously, Solomon is telling us. As if we'll suffer some great loss if we don't get all that we want. Don't worry about it, man. It won't satisfy you anyway. So what if you never get that dream house? Once you get it, it won't satisfy you. Just take the pressure off. You got to get above the sun to find the true meaning of life. Reinhold Messner was a famous mountain climber. Messner was the first man to climb Mount Everest without an oxygen bottle. And when asked the proverbial question that all mountain climbers get asked, why did you do it? Messner responded, because at the top, all the lines converge. This is the way it is with life. Only in God do all the lines intersect, do all the pieces come together. All of life finds its purpose only as we relate it to God. Well, chapter 2 closes. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Once there was an insurance agent who got a phone call one night. A woman asked him, "Do you sell homeowners insurance?" He says, "Well, of course." She asked, "Well, can I buy it over the phone?" The insurance agent said, "No, I'm sorry. I'll first have to come out and then I'll have to see your house." She replied, "Well, you better hurry. It's on fire." Timing is a crucial element in life. And Solomon realizes the importance of timing. Just as God established seasons of the year, there are also seasons in life. And one of the keys to success is recognizing the season that you're in. Chapter 3 begins, "To everything, there is a season. Time for every purpose under heaven. There's a time to be born. And there's a time to die. There's a time to plant. And there's a time to pluck what is planted." In other words, there's a time to sow. And then there's a time to reap. There's a time to be born. And you don't know what time that is. They give you a due date, but it doesn't really matter. It doesn't mean anything. It's just kind of a placebo. And there's a time to die. You don't know when that time is either. Could be tonight. You never know. God knows. He's established a time. Time to be born. Time to die. Time to plant. A time to pluck what is planted. A time to kill. Hope you notice here, God is not a pacifist. There is a time to kill. Capital punishment is a time to kill. Self-defense could be a time to kill. Just wars are a time to kill. Mosquitoes at a picnic are a time to kill. And a time to heal. You've heard it said, time heals all wounds. And indeed it does. I like the striking worker at the picket line. He was holding up this placard that read, time heals all wounds. Time and a half heals them faster. There's also a time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. Time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones. You know, there's a graveyard on the Mount of Olives, and on top of each of the tombs are a pile of stones. And I've been told that there's an Israeli law that forbids flowers on a grave. And here's why. Flowers are expensive. Cut flowers on a grave would discriminate against the poor. Only the rich would be able to express their sorrow and their respect for the dead. But stones. Israel is the rockiest place on the planet. There are rocks everywhere. Thus, a grave in Israel with lots of rocks on it is a sign that the deceased was dearly loved and dearly respected. Put rocks on the graves. There's a time to cast away stones, and there's a time to gather up stones. There's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Hugs at home are always appropriate. My wife and my kids can hug me anytime, all the time. We love hugs at home. Hugs at church are usually appropriate. Even brothers can hug in church. It's understood, it's appreciated, it's accepted. Hugging pretty girls is dangerous if you're a guy. When I hug a pretty girl, unless she's my wife, I gotta go for the side saddle hug or the no body hug. No frontal hugs for pretty girls, not for me. Two guys hugging at Walmart is probably not the right time to hug. If you see me at Walmart, shake my hand. Don't come and give me a hug, guys. Please. There's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. There's also a time to gain and a time to lose. You know, sometimes progress is two steps forward and one step backwards. There's a time to gain, there's a time to lose. Verse 6, there's a time to keep and a time to throw away. Here's a biblical basis for garage sales right here. It's a time to keep and there's a time to throw away. There's a time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war in a time of peace. For in a world filled with sin and sinners, there will come a time when good men will have to take up arms and fight back evil men. It's inevitable. There's a time for war, and there's a time for peace. You see, there's a time or there's a season for everything. And here's one of the keys to life. It's recognizing and enjoying and cooperating with whatever season that you're in. You know, it's been said a successful farmer knows that nature works for him only if he works with nature. I mean, try to sow when it's time to reap, or try to reap when it's time to sow, and you're destined for frustration. But if you're patient and if you're discerning of the season, you'll avoid a lot of life's futility and a lot of life's irritations. If you're single, enjoy being single. You know, don't wish that you were married. If you're married, relish the joys of married life. You know, people say marriage is like the screen door. There's flies on one side trying to get in. There's flies on the other side trying to get out. Just enjoy where you are. If you're single, enjoy it. If you're married, enjoy it. If it's time to build, work long hours. Take advantage of the work that you have. If it's time to relax, man, turn off your cell phone. Take a nap. Get some lemonade. Embracing the season reduces the stress. He says, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. You are a child of time. You occupy time. But God has broken off a little chip of eternity, and he has planted it in every human heart so that no matter what time you're in, we will long for more. We long for eternity. As Solomon says in verse 11, God has put eternity in their hearts. Beyond time, we sense eternity, and we all long to experience its reality. We were made for eternity, and we'll all get there in time. Philip Yancey writes this. He says, made for another home, made for eternity, we finally realize that nothing this side of timeless paradise will quiet the rumors of discontent. God gives us all things to enjoy, but if we get too attached to life under the sun, we are setting ourselves up for a letdown. Our home is eternity. We won't find true satisfaction until we arrive. In the meantime, God is the master artist. But you don't rush an artist. Each brushstroke is deliberate and important. This is why he makes everything beautiful in his time. Verse 12, I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Again, since real satisfaction is only found above the sun in spiritual things, how should we handle the tangible, temporal, terrestrial blessings? Well, we should enjoy them. That's what God gave them to us for. A good meal, an evening of family fun, the smell of a new car, a tax refund check, the opening of baseball season. Your kid, you put him in soccer and he scores a goal. A bowl of ice cream at night before you go to bed. The new couch you've been wanting. These are all blessings from God. So enjoy them. Make the most of them. Relish them. You know, this is why Ecclesiastes is read by the Jews at the Feast of Tabernacles. Because it was a feast of celebration. The Feast of Tabernacles is in the fall, and it corresponds to the fall harvest. It's a time of thanksgiving and praise and celebration and enjoyment. Solomon is telling us to enjoy and be grateful for God's blessings. Just don't look to stuff under the sun for fulfillment, because it will disappoint you and it will disillusion you. How do you treat this life? You lighten up. You take it for what it is. You enjoy it, yes, but you don't expect too much out of it. It matters, maybe a little, but not much. You realize that what matters most in life is above the sun. Verse 14, I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which has already been and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Not only is there an eternity, but God's work is eternal. It's permanent and it's final. And we are creatures of time, but God is timeless. He sits outside of time. He's above the timeline. He sees the end from the beginning, and men will give an account to him of the deeds that they do and of the life that they live. So your life does matter. One day you're going to answer to God for how you spent it. And here's what really eats at the preacher. Verse 16, moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. Man, I looked to Washington. In the place of judgment, people who were making the laws, people who were on the bench, and there was wickedness there. And in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. And this really eats at him. In the words of the old saying, right is on the scaffold, and wrong is on the throne. This is not the way it's supposed to be, Solomon is saying. And yet Solomon knows that one day in God's time, he will make everything beautiful. He will right all wrongs, for he says, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. Now the rest of the chapter addresses another frustration. The preacher knows that God exalted man above the animals, that he gave Adam dominion over the animal kingdom. And yet he concedes that there's very little difference between a man's life and an animal's life. I mean, every man eats and sleeps and lives and eventually dies like a dog. We buried our dog last year, buried him in the ground. One day they're going to bury me in the ground. They've been saying they're going to bury me next to her. That's what they've been saying. I won't care. But we go through life, we live, we eat, we enjoy our life. But then in the end, we're no different than an animal. We just get put right back in the ground. We die like a dog. He's frustrated by this. He says, I said in my heart concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to the dust. The way some people treat their animals, you think the animals have the advantage. But he says they all, man, animals, they both die, they go back to dust. And then he adds here in verse 21, who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal which goes down to the earth? Notice that's a question. He's not stating what he considers to be a fact here. He's just sort of asking the question, who knows? Who knows where the soul goes, is what he's saying. He's expressing the vagueness and his own frustration, just looking at things under the sun, not factoring God in, not factoring revelation in, but just looking at things empirically under the sun, just kind of looking at things as they are. Who knows? You know, all we see is that the body dies, it goes back into the ground. Nobody sees the soul. So he's just saying, who knows? It's frustrating to him. Now, some folks take this verse to mean that the spirit of man goes upward. It goes back to God. It lives forever, whereas the soul of little Rover ceases to exist. It just goes back to the ground and ends in the dust. And if you're attached to a dog, this can be upsetting. It is a possible interpretation. But just keep in mind, the preacher's point is simpler. He's just reflecting on the world's despair as to what it sees concerning the afterlife. It sees very little. You know, Christians, when you think about it, Christians believe that when the body dies, the spirit does live forever. But there's no empirical evidence to support that view. You know, the spirit can't be detected by a stethoscope. It doesn't show up in a blood sample or in a DNA test. Our hope in the afterlife is really a matter of faith, not scientific confirmation. The reason we believe in life after death is really only one reason. It's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus rose, we'll rise with him. This is why Paul refers to Jesus as the first fruits of our resurrection. Jesus taught the doctrine of the resurrection, and then he returned from the dead to validate its truth. But just looking at life under the sun, he's saying, who knows? He says, so I perceived that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him?
We all want our lives to have meaning. We strive after people and positions that will give us recognition or profit us financially, all in an effort to add purpose and happiness to our existence. In the end, though, we'll come to a similar conclusion as Solomon, the writer of Ecclesiastes. It's all in vain. These moments of pleasure we strive so hard for won't last. We'll find ourselves longing for more. So what can we do? There's only one answer that will satisfy every soul for all of time. That's Jesus. He came to earth to give us new life and fill us with joy, a joy that will last for eternity. When we follow Jesus' plan for our lives, we'll discover the purpose we long for. Would you like to know more about Jesus and how he satisfies your deepest needs? We'd love to talk with you, so give us a call at 770-736-2828. We're so glad you tuned in for today's message on Sandy Adams Radio. If you're listening in the Atlanta area, why not come visit us for our Sunday morning worship services? Join us at 9:30 or 11:15 to hear from the Bible, worship the Creator, and get to know some ordinary people who just want to share the love and grace we found in Christ. You'll find more information at sandyadams.org. Thanks for being part of our time here today on Sandy Adams Radio.